The Midnight Myth Podcast presents The Wheel of Ka, an exploration into the writings of Stephen King. What started as two friends rereading The Dark Tower has turned into an exploration of Stephen King's writing writ large. This episode, we talk The Shining.
The wind sighed through the trees, and the fallen leaves rattled up the deserted walks and around the hubcaps of parked cars. It was a faint and sorrowful sound, and the boy thought that he might be the only one in Boulder awake enough to hear it. The only human being, at least. There was no way of knowing what else might be out in the night, slinking hungrily through the shadows, watching and scenting the breeze. I'll find you. I'll find you. Tony? He whispered again, but without much hope. Only the wind spoke back, gusting more strongly this time, scattering leaves across the sloping roof below his window. Some of them slipped into the rain gutter and came to rest there like tired dancers. Danny. Danny. He started at the sound of that familiar voice and craned out the window, his small hands on the sill. With the sound of Tony's voice, the whole night seemed to have come silently and secretly alive, whispering even when the wind quieted again and the leaves were still and the shadows had stopped moving. He thought he saw a darker shadow standing by the bus stop a block down, but it was hard to tell if that was the real thing or an eye trick. Don't go, Danny. Then the wind gusted again, making him squint, and the shadow by the bus stop was gone, if it had ever been there at all. He stood by his window for a minute, an hour, sometime longer, but there was no more. At last he crept back into his bed and pulled the blankets up and watched the shadows thrown by the alien streetlight turn into a sinuous jungle filled with flesh-eating plants that wanted to only slip around him, squeeze the life out of him, and drag him down into a blackness where sinister word flashed in red. Red rum.
Fellow travelers on the path of the beam, Wheel of Ka is back after a very long, really way too long break. I am so happy to be here. If you're following us on the social medias, which I hope you are, this is us doing our long-awaited, our most anticipated, probably one of the books requested the most by you, the fans of Wheel of Ka.
Yep.
We are talking about The Shining.
Oh.
It is a straight-up ghost story. Steve is feeling spooky.
Man.
It's 2023, a new year.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if you're listening to the regular Midnight Myth feed, but one of the reasons this episode got delayed is Laurel and I moved. And also, Steve, you moved.
Yeah, and put our house up for sale.
Yeah,
so it's
it slows down the reading.
It does. Yeah, and an almost one-year-old.
Yes.
It also slows down. But now we're here, and we're back. I'll tell you, this is it's a shorter distance between the last one we did and this one, for sure.
Is
so,
it?
Yeah.
So I have no concept of time anymore.
I feel like it was like 6 months. We always go back and be like, Steve, it was a year and a half. Also, I'd like to comment that I think I've started almost every Wheel of Ka episode with a bodily function, just like, ugh. Oh, God, we're here. Oh, so I apologize if that makes anybody feel weird.
But. Well, if you're listening still to the Wheel of Ka, I think you got over that.
Yeah, you're pretty used to it by now.
Well, we are here. We have read The Shining. We are ready to talk about it. I anticipate this being a big conversation. I don't know about you. I've got a lot of thoughts. I've got a lot of notes. I've got a lot of quotes.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of things to get into. But, you know, just, man, hit me with how you feeling.
Oh, I'm never properly prepared for this question, ever. I'm good. I'm very good, actually. Great holidays, new year, you know, a lot of cogs moving in different wheels. I feel I'm excited to be back here and using my brain outside of parent space. Honestly, as much as I love it, it's good to sit down and critically think about something that I love with a dear friend. So I'm very excited to talk about this. It's kind of funny. We started The Shining, and we kind of stopped because you sold the house, you moved. We had a few things going on, and then in about 2.5 weeks, we both just fled through the book. You know, it was, I mean, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah, I had to get, so not only did I move, when I do my reading, I don't know if this is too much information for you guys listening or not, but I'm going to tell you either way, because this is my podcast. So you're going to listen to it. To do my reading, I have to get up very early in the morning. One, I'm not really good in the evening. I'm usually shot. I go to bed really early. So I have to get up really early in the morning if I'm going to do any reading. And we moved, and my son Arthur, who's now 2, is in daycare. And where we moved to, there wasn't an available daycare. So we had to be put onto waiting lists. So I had to drive almost 1.5 hours each way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Early in the morning to get my son to and from daycare, which meant my reading time in the morning was gone.
Shot.
And we finally got Arthur into a daycare, and I picked The Shining up, and it is one of the books that, though we've been reading for a while, the actual time spent reading was relatively short.
It was. I agree. It was another one just like it. I couldn't put it down. You know, there were times where I would have to remind myself, like, hey, I need to put this book down and go to work.
Yes.
You know, I have responsibility. Like, I actually have to do things. And it's not that the other books haven't done that, but this is the first one in a little while where like you said before, the pages just kind of come up off the page, and they kind of surround your brain. And that's how this was for me, for sure. I spent a lot of time thinking about this book from the perspective of a parent. And that's a big theme for me in this episode, is that this is the first book I've read all the way through where my daughter was born. So I have a much different perspective, I think, now than I would have even 6 months ago if we had read this book.
Yeah. Well, so Laurel and I read The Shining for our 2019 episode on The Shining that we did. It was our Halloween episode. And we talked about almost 90% of that episode's about the movie. So we read the book, but we really didn't talk about it. That's pre-parent.
Yeah.
And now I have read it post-parent, and I definitely think it's different, but we will get into all of that.
Yeah.
To make my wife happy, I'm going to do some necessary social media podcasting plugs. So please follow us at DerekJones198 on Twitter. There's at The Midnight Myth, which is our main podcast. There is a at Wheel of Ka Twitter, but it's been pretty dormant.
Yeah, it's okay. No, it's coming back in 2023.
Is it?
Yeah. I'm going to make a very concerted effort, because I think we're going to read more, and we're going to record more often.
Well, and you can see by that response who handles the Wheel of Ka Twitter. It's Steve,
it's
not
my
me.
Fault. Yeah.
I only do one Twitter.
Yeah.
My wife has also launched Sleep and Sorcery.
Oh, it's so good.
For a little while now. It's fantasy, folklore, and mythology themed stories to listen to help you fall asleep. It's part guided meditation, part sleepy narrative. It's really exceptional. She's also on Twitter. I think all the things are on Facebook, Instagram as well, but Twitter's the main one that you should talk to us. And I know, Steve, you have another podcast in.
Yes.
Mythic Thunder Loot. Give us a Mythic Thunder Loot plug/update.
Yeah, Mythic Thunder Loot, the D&D podcast musical that I record with some old friends and new friends, old friends from college, new friends from the career. And that's what it is. It's four you know, really eccentric characters fighting their way through some really ridiculous events. And it's all circled around the game of Dungeons and Dragons. But it is a musical. It is a full musical. There are produced numbers. There are sound effects. There are full-blown scenes. And we are almost finished recording the first season. So there is...
You mean the second season?
No, it's technically the second half of the first season.
Oh, okay. Didn't realize that.
Yeah,
sorry.
The first half is done, and there's an album of the first 10 songs of the record as well. And you can find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, excuse me. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If there's a social media site, Mythic Thunder Loot's on it. So check it out.
I just want to give an extra special plug to Mythic Thunder Loot. The first episodes are amazing. Steve plays the drums. He also plays a character called Roscoe, who is hysterical, funny, and has a truly transcendent singing voice.
Ah, thank you. Thank you very much.
I really recommend it. It is a ton of fun. If you're into the Wheel of Ka, the Midnight Myth, the Sleep and Sorcery, you will be into Mythic Thunderloot. I wholeheartedly endorse it.
Also, if you're into stupid comedy and weed, you'll absolutely love Mythic Thunderloot.
Absolutely, because there's a lot of that in it. All right, let's go with The Shining.
Oh, God. Let's dive into this book.
We all know the story. Torrances, they go to the Overlook. Danny has this psychic power called The Shine. And in it, the Overlook comes to life and tries to kill them through Jack. And Danny and Wendy escape with their life. There's the character Dick Halloran. There's not a ton of plot in this at all.
No.
It's ne'er say plotless. And it is a great book. You had already talked about how much fun it was to read. For me, it was incredibly fun. I constantly wrestle with, what do I like better, The Shining, the book, or the movie? The Shining, the movie, has been in my life, a lot longer than the book. I just want to know, Steve, hit me with your general impressions, thoughts. Just make it as broad and open-ended. What did you think of this book?
Sure. So it's the first time I've ever read it. And, you know, I had some expectations going into it, more than some of the other books, just knowing, you know, the background, all the background with the film and the controversy, and just knowing that, you know, this is one of the stories that really launched King's career into the stratosphere. You know, he was popular up until now, and this really blew it up. To me, it was tough. It was a hard read. Being a father, you know, there were a lot of times where I struggled with decisions being made by parents and thinking, you know, how in the world would I react if I was under the influence of a, you know, fucking ghost house? It was crazy. I felt a lot of emotions. I will say it's the second time since we've done the Wheel of Ka outside of the Dark Tower. I'm qualifying this a lot. King of qualifying is that this book made me weep several times. I felt very emotionally invested in this story, much like I was emotionally invested in the Losers Club and the Quartet. You know, in a weird way, I don't want to say that the three of them are Quartet, because they're not. I at least don't think that they are.
Do the three mean Danny, Jack, Wendy, and Jack? Wendy. I have some thoughts about that. I have a quote. I have some thoughts about
that. I know you will. This is going to be the part that blows my mind.
If you want me to get into it, hold on. Let me go finish your thought. I'll find the quote
on
my notes.
So to me, you know, this is the first time that I've also felt that I've read a Stephen King book. Like I said, from a parental experience, and what I mean by that really is I've always viewed myself as a very, not young individual, but sort of a juvenile. You know, in that I'm an only child, and I love the spice of life, but sometimes I can be a little naive. And I feel like this is the first book where, as a parent, now raising a fucking human, you know, I don't know, the experience was just different. I was reading it through more mature eyes. I was reading it through, and it's one of the first books that made my stomach turn, honestly. So that's, and I loved it.
Okay, I was going to say, did you like it?
No, I did. I did. I like the struggle. I'm like that with film and television as an actor. I want to be wrung through the mud. It's pretty rare where I'll sit down and read something that's just like happy and makes me feel good. This is the shit that makes me feel good in a weird way.
I 100% know what you're talking about. I intuitively know what you're talking about, that when it's complicated and messy, that kind of is what draws you to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been reading Stephen King books exclusively for the last, 2 years?
Over 2 years at this point.
You know, 2.5 years. I'm not sure the exact time. That says something about us.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
It says something about us, what we like to consume.
Yeah, we're fucked up white guys.
We want it weird. We want it messy.
Yeah, 100%.
We don't want it simple and easy. We want it grotesque and strange and bizarre and complicated, because Stephen King's books are all of those things. You know, I did read the book pre-parent and post-parent.
Yeah, well, how did you feel about it this time specifically?
That word that you said, that it's different, is very true.
Yeah.
I think pre-parent, I saw the book primarily through Danny's eyes, and I imagined myself more as what it would be if I were Danny. obviously was an adult when I read it. Post-parent, I saw the story from Jack's eyes. Mm. I saw myself more as Jack, in particular with a infant, now toddler son, pardon me. So the toddler son who I sometimes have to punish and get really mad at because they misbehave. And I see, God, this is going to sound terrible. I see a little bit of Jack in me, not in the alcoholic, narcissistic way, but the idea that as a parent, you lose your temper and you're not always at your best when you're trying to talk and improve your kid's behavior and wondering like, oh my God, am I making a mistake? Is this timeout too long? Did I raise my voice too high? And having an immense feeling of guilt when you think, oh man, I did nothing but yell at my kid tonight.
Yeah, of course.
And reading it now as a parent when my kid is misbehaving, I am absolutely trying to be more patient.
Well, you know what the good part is? You don't have a Roque mallet or Croquet mallet.
Is it Roku? Roku? I have no idea. I've never heard of it.
No, Roku is like a TV.
Oh, no, yeah, it's Roque.
Yeah,
okay, it's a Roque mallet.
I mean, you're not, you know,
I'm glad we worked
you're not
that out.
Chasing your family through your home with a Roque.
No, I'm not saying that.
I know what you mean, though.
It is a very different experience not having a kid, especially being a dad and a boy dad.
Yeah.
And now having a kid that runs around and talks and speaks and misbehaves the way kids do and being like, oh my God, like I can see how the Jack character got to the point where he was susceptible to the evil of the Overlook.
You can see the test.
Yes.
You can clearly see the test.
And it made me in this read, oddly, we talked about this while reading it, way more sympathetic to Jack than I think I was the first time around.
Yeah, you know, I struggled with Jack, you know? I mean, for the first half of the book, I was sympathetic to a point, but there is, deep down inside of me, I'm like, hey, man, this is your family.
Yeah.
You're the father of this family. I mean, first of all, you know, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into this, but why in the world would you put your family in that situation to begin with? I don't understand that.
And by that, you mean taking them to the Overlook at all?
In the middle of nowhere, to be shut in the middle of winter alone in a strange hotel that has a sordid past to like become a caretaker? When the hell have you ever done that? You're a writer.
And kids get sick. Kids get hurt. Kids could easily be in a scenario where they need emergency care.
He's five.
And you are snowed in the middle of nowhere for 2.5 months.
Yeah. I just from the very get-go, I found myself angry at Jack, being like, why would you ever stick your family in the middle of this? And then you start to come to find out about his past. And you know, look, man, alcoholism, past abuse, PTSD, you know, trauma, that stuff really does make a person.
Okay, we're putting the cart way before the horse.
I always do this.
No, that's okay, dude. There's nothing.
It wouldn't
to
be
our
a
podcast.
Wheel of Ka episode if I didn't start bringing shit up way early. We got to do the background.
Yeah, let's talk about. Yeah. I know you did a lot of research in this, so hit me with when this book was written. Where was King in his path as a writer? Mm-hmm. And where does this fit in the overall story of the tower?
Oh, excellent. And I also have a quote. Oh, I just dropped something.
That's okay.
Sorry, it was one of the pop figures. Okay.
A Buffy the Vampire Funko Pop.
So sorry. All right. So The Shining was originally released in 1977. It is his third published novel and his first hardback bestseller. It's his very first. The success of the novel firmly established King as the, quote, preeminent author in the horror genre. So this is the book that changed the way that horror was being written at that time. The settings and the characters were influenced by King's own experiences, including his visit to the Stanley Hotel, which is what The Overlook is based on, in 1974, and his struggle with alcoholism. And I was on the Stephen King website, of all places, and I have a quote that I took from, and it says, quote, in late 19... 19- or in late September of 1974, Tabby, his wife, and I spent a night at the Grand Old Hotel in Estes Park, the Stanley. We were the only guests, as it turned out. The following day, they were going to close the place down for winter. Wandering through its corridors, I thought that it seemed the perfect, maybe the archetypical, setting for a ghost story. That night, I dreamed of my three-year-old son running through the corridors, looking back over his shoulder, eyes wide, screaming. He was being chased by a fire hose. I woke up with a tremendous jerk, sweating all over, within an inch of falling out of the bed. I got up, lit a cigarette, sat in the chair looking at the window at the Rockies, and by the time the cigarette was done, I had the bones of the book firmly set in my mind.
Oh, man, I love that.
I mean,
I absolutely love that.
They're the only people in that hotel the night before they close it. Of course.
You know what I like about it, too? Like, this was, and I did not know this literally until right now. This was King's first smash hit.
Yes. This is the first bestseller. It's the first one that really launched him from being like, oh, this guy's a pretty good writer, into a superstar. And he would go on to write The Stand next.
Wow.
Yeah.
Imagine your third book you've ever written being The Shining.
Yeah, you've got Carrie, Salem's Lot, and then The Shining.
And The Shining is considered by many to be his best.
Yeah.
And is considered to be one of the best stories. It goes on to be, without a doubt, in my opinion, the best film adaptation of a King work.
Oh, sure.
I know Stephen King doesn't like the movie that much.
Well, Kubrick took his liberties, you know?
Absolutely, but it is still a landmark in both literature and film.
So a couple of other like really interesting tidbits that I found out. So originally there was a prologue and an epilogue that had chronicled the events from the Overlook history, from part of what he finds in the basement. In the scrapbook, and they were titled Before the Play and After the Play. The prologue was published in this magazine called Whispers in August of 1982, and the epilogue, thought to be lost, was actually rediscovered in 2016 in a part of an early manuscript of The Shining that was unearthed. So that's pretty much the background, and this is what, you know, this is the book that would make Stephen King, you know, who he is today, 100%.
Wow. So yeah. The Shining, it's like Steven Spielberg, another Steven. It's like their Jaws.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's the movie that's like, this is what you are now. This is what you do, and you're great at it.
Because, you know, horror fans were really into Carrie and really into Salem's Lot. They're quick reads. But this is one of the first books where, like, your normal everyday person that was just reading a novel, oh, I've heard about this guy, Stephen King. Let me pick up The Shining. And then it was like hearsay. It was like fucking fireworks. And people picked it up and read it and read it and read it, you know, which led to the Kubrick movie.
I don't know if you guys can hear this, but my son is screaming. I have no idea this is being picked up on the mic at all.
And if it is, hey, this is life.
And I just want to say, I love you, wife, for dealing with the screaming toddler so we can do the podcast. If it's not on there and you don't know what I'm talking about, I apologize. But if you can hear it, my wife is a saint.
Yes, agreed.
I think that's really, really cool. You know, funny thing, Laurel and I had planned a Colorado vacation. Her family lives in Colorado, and we were going to stay at the Stanley Hotel, and they do this, like, midnight cocktail Stephen King tour.
Oh, yeah.
And we booked it, and we were going to do it, and then freaking COVID happened.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
We did not get to do it. We were so excited. We're going to go to Colorado, hang out with my wife's family, dip out for a weekend and do the Stanley thing.
To do the Stanley Hotel.
And we did not get to do it because COVID happened. And now, then we decided to have a baby. So
yeah.
Who knows when we'll get to do it.
Take him when he's five.
Absolutely love it. Let's talk a little bit how this book relates to the tower.
Yeah.
Did you have some tower thoughts, references? This whole project that we do is to relate books to the tower because as much as I am a Stephen King fan, at this point, I think I have some bona fide Stephen King credentials. I'm still a Dark Tower fan first, if that makes sense.
For sure. No, it does. It does. I've really enjoyed digging into other Stephen King work because it's made me feel closer to the author, like knowing him more, and it influences the way that I look at the Dark Tower as well. I mean, for me, first of all, there's the obvious one, right? There's The Shine, otherwise in the Dark Tower known as The Touch. Now, I've seen some conflicting information about this online. I believe them to be the same thing.
Wait, there are those online that think they're not.
Yeah, there's this one argument that The Shine is more inherent, like kind of on this plane of the beam, and that The Touch is sort of, I don't want to say omnipotent, but you know what I mean? Like, it's The Touch is much more psychological, and it's less spiritual than The Shine.
I don't buy that argument.
No, I think it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I think it's bullshit. I think they're the same thing. I think they just have a different name.
I think in King's story universe / multiverse, I think extrasensory perception, ESP, is a phenomenon that happens. I think one thing that you see in The Dark Tower is characters kind of can develop the touch.
Yeah.
Versus in The Shining, it seems like you're born with it or not.
Right. And it's precognition too. It's a form of second sight, which is huge in Stephen King's work. And I think, I mean, we don't know how Dick got it. We don't know how Dick Halloran got The Shine. You know, with Danny, it seems like it just happens. He's five. We have no idea because it's not a phenomenon that's known in an everyday world here, where in mid-world, it absolutely is.
Yeah,
it's part of their vernacular.
It's definitely present enough in Roland's universe that they have a name for it that people commonly share. Whereas in the universe that Jack and Wendy and Danny and Dick live in, as well as Pennywise the Clown lives in, because Dick Halloran is a character in it.
And if you think about it, I mean, Jake Chambers, at one point in time, part of Jake is in this world. So, and he has The Shine as well, you know, because there's the other characters that have The Shine or The Touch that are directly connected.
Yeah, I don't think, and I think it's kind of missing the point to me to go deep into what exactly is the root of the power.
Right.
And where does the power come? What can the power do or not do? And is it slightly different in The Dark Tower than it is in the book The Shining?
That's just nitpicky.
To me, that's missing the point. The idea is, in the Stephen King multiverse, some characters can have ESP.
Yeah.
And it is slightly mysterious. It is slightly known. In Roland's world, it's more common. But it's worth noting that in the world of Danny's and Dick Halloran's, Dick Halloran meets people who say, yeah, you know, sometime I just get a sense.
Yep.
It's common enough. So to me, those are people that in Roland's vernacular be like, yeah, they got a little bit of the touch.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not strong. They got a little bit of the touch.
And where it is strong is based on relationship. You know, it's who are we? Are we connected as a quartet? Like Dick and Danny in this book, they have this just inherent, you know, whatever bound, call it whatever you want, fate, whatever. They're bound together. And so their shine is very bright with one another. You know, same thing with Elaine and Roland, you know, and the same thing with Cuthbert. You know, where Elaine could reach out to them because of their connection in the quartet, where, you know, there was one person trying to argue, like, well, oh, yeah, Roland has the touch. No, he doesn't. He fights that. He fights that with every fiber of his being. But Elaine is such a, their connection is deep and family and rooted that he's able to use the touch on them to communicate. And I think it's interesting that it's a communication tool first. Mm-hmm. More than anything else, it's not a healing tool. You know, it's not a motivational tool. It's not a, it doesn't give you strength. It bonds you in communication, which I think is interesting.
Another piece of evidence, and that's a great point, that links the powers of the touch to me to the powers of the Shining. Page 117, Dick asks Danny, like, send me a message as hard as you can. And Danny sends him one, and it rocks Dick's brain.
Yeah.
It almost scrambles his brain.
It almost gives him a stroke.
Yeah, because Danny sends him such a tidal wave of psychic energy. Well, Ted Brodigan does this.
That's right.
In the Dark Tower book 7.
The Breakers.
He uses his psychic ability to send a psychic spear and can literally stab someone's brain. And that's a very similar style power that shows me that, like, the touch, the shine, whatever you want to call it, different people can do different things with it. It is the human brain having some innate ESP, where it comes from, how it operates, what it means. Certainly we could debate them, but the fact that there are characters in Roland's world that can read minds, who can speak without moving their mouths, who can sense and have dreams and see things in the future, and can send psychic spears, to me is enough to say that these are comparable powers.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree.
And maybe not exactly 100% the same, but that's not the point to me.
No, I mean, none of it's exactly the same.
Right. Do you have any other tower things you want to pick out?
I mean, you know, the interesting thing, I always think, like, the one question I've had is, you know, where is the overlook on the path of the beam? Is it on a broken path? Is it connected somehow to Derry? Where is it on the same beam? I don't know. You know, these are things that I think that they're not directly in the book.
I have a thought.
Ah,
I thought about that a lot. And I went back and I re-listened to the audiobook of The Wastelands and the chapter with Dutch Hill House. And a connection that I have is that the Overlook and the Dutch Hill House are kind of analogous in that they're almost living, breathing places. Mm. And they are places known to be haunted and people innately fear. And people that are stronger in the touch, the house seems to come alive when Jake is in there.
Yeah.
The house seems to cut, the hotel seems to come alive when Danny is in there. And in it, in the Dutch Hill House, Jake has this idea that, can the people outside actually see what's happening here? And he says, no, because the Dutch Hill House is in between worlds somehow. It's in between, and that way it can be a portal from one world to another. In the Dark Tower, we know that death can be a portal from one world to another.
Right.
And I think in a weird way, the Overlook is another place that exists somewhat loosely between worlds, mm-hmm. almost like one half of its foundation was built in Todash space.
Yeah.
And the rest of it was built on this earth.
I completely agree.
And that it's kind of in between. It's not on a path of the beam. It's in between. And that's where the monstrous and evil can kind of seep in. Mm-hmm. So I think to me, I was just, while reading The Overlook coming to life, I was reading Dutch Hill House coming to life. And I'm like, these are very comparable narratives, though Dutch Hill House, where Jake enters to travel into Midworld in the Wastelands, is different. And the house literally turns into a monster and tries to eat Jake. And in the Overlook, the ghosts sort of possess and inhabit Jack, but they are still trying to psychically eat Jake.
Yeah.
Or Danny in The Shining. So they are still trying to absorb it so they could absorb his power. And I felt like if we're trying to understand where the Overlook exists in the levels of the tower, maybe it's in this place that's sort of in between.
And Danny and Jake are very similar, if you ask me. They're very similar in both their background, the way that they carry themselves, the way they look at the world. You know, and
bright.
They're very similar. Bright.
Yep. Psychically powered.
Yep.
Shy.
Yep.
Abusive, neglected parents. Mm-hmm. Jake is obviously very wealthy. Danny is not very wealthy.
Yeah, that's the opposite there.
But there's a world where Jack Torrance is insanely successful.
And hyped up on cocaine.
He would look a lot like Jake's dad.
Yeah, they're very, very similar.
You know, like, there's another world where Jack Torrance is Jake Chambers' father.
Yeah.
You know, except he doesn't go to the Overlook and become evil, but he is still a substance abuser.
Yeah.
He still doesn't understand his son.
Yep.
Even if his son loves him to death, he still is not a great dad.
And the mother doesn't understand her husband. And they're very, very similar.
You know, and so there's a similar family dynamic. They're both single kids. Jake Chambers is like 12, obviously, and Danny's 5. So they're not like 100% analogous, but there's enough similarities there. They're both very handsome, you know, and they're both a little small for their age.
Yep.
So there's all of these things that are very similar. I agree that Jake and Danny feel like their stories have some eerie connections and similarities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely agree.
Totally agree. Do you have any other tower stuff? I have a whole crap load, dude.
I mean,
I've got big, little, small. We've got into some of, like, Danny and Jake being that Dutch Hill and Overlook were some of my
those
big
ones.
Those
are the pretty big ones. No, let me hear your thoughts.
So a few things, little things, just little things I picked out. The bar in the Overlook Hotel has batwing doors. Just like the bars that you see both in Tull and in Magus, and every bar Roland goes into has batwing doors. So just a little thing. Which brings me to a broader thing is that the gunslinger, the story of the gunslinger is very much, it's many things, but it's also a Western. It takes place in the West of America, in this forgotten, broken down, weird America. This is another story that takes place in the West, in Colorado. It's not a story about New England. It's not shaped and formed by New England. So I think that's another, you know, similarity. They're about the American West. Other just little things. All of the masks at the party in the masquerade ball, they're all wearing animal masks.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of the Taheen.
Yeah, for sure.
And then some of the Taheen wear human masks. So that's another, just a little reference here and there. And I think the big connections to me are the touch and the shine, which we've already talked about. We've already touched on. See what I did there?
And clever.
And the Overlook and the Dutch Hill House.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's a lots of little tidbits there.
Well, the other thing that this is after this. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, to the point of whether or not the family is a quartet. And I want to draw you to a passage. It happens on page 79. And we're in a chapter from Wendy's point of view. And she's thinking about the past. She's thinking about Jack's drinking. And this idea that her son might have some sort of ESP. And she thinks, I don't believe in such things. But in sleep, she did believe them. And in sleep, with her husband's seed still drying on her thighs, she felt that the three of them had been permanently wielded together. But if their three oneness is to be destroyed, it would be destroyed. It would not be destroyed by any of them, but from the outside. To me, that is, she's thinking, okay, we are a quartet. We are from many one. And as a point from many one, we are going to... it's going to be the outside that destroys this. Mm. And it lays the seed very early in the narrative that it is the Overlook that brings them down more so than anything one individual of
and
them
I,
does.
I agree with that completely.
One last, and this is like a big picture tower reference, Ka is a wheel. Its only job is to turn. Mm-hmm. It's a cycle. Mm-hmm. And this story is very much about cycles of abuse repeating.
100%.
So Wendy, we'll touch on her real quickly. Wendy has a cold and distant mother who is constantly trying to drive a wedge between her and her father. And Wendy recognizes that a part of her is jealous because Danny is a daddy's boy.
Yeah.
And she wishes that he was a mommy's boy. And so she represents that cycle. Jack, his life has been one of dealing with alcoholic, violent, abusive male role models after another and him living and becoming his dad.
Oh, for sure.
In the moments where the Overlook is most gripping Jack, he literally starts to think, oh, my dad had it right. He was correct.
Yeah.
To so harshly discipline.
Yeah.
And he becomes his father. And if Ka is a wheel, its only job is to turn. The poor Torrances didn't have much of a chance.
No. No. Jack had zero chance from the first line of the book. And it's pretty clear. You know, I mean, he, unfortunately, being the weakest of the three, you know, it is like we said in the beginning, you know, this did come from a lot of Stephen King's personal experiences as an alcoholic. I do think that there is a lot of King in Jack, you know, good, bad, or otherwise. Not to say that The Shining is autobiographical, but I do think he pulls a lot from his experience in life. You know, if, and it's tough. I mean, abuse, it begets abuse. It's a really difficult cycle. You know, when people start to talk about nature versus nurture, I mean, look what your parents do and what they pass on to you. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Again, you know, they're going to pass a lot of things on, because the truth is we have no fucking clue what we're doing, and we're making it up as we go. And Jack, from the very beginning, he stood no chance. And Wendy, being a devoted, loving mother, loving wife, I mean, why, to me, a wife who constantly smells my breath to make sure that I'm not on the wagon again, Jack looks at that as being an imposition.
Isn't it off the wagon?
Off the wagon, yeah.
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 Right?
I'm always on the wagon.
I'm on the wagon. So, but, yeah, it's off the wagon.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
And the truth, I mean, her being there, little things like that, just thinking about, you know, the patience of a father, the patience of a leader, what that means in a unit. And I don't know, I just think Jack from the very beginning is doomed. There's no question.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting point. It's in the snowmobile chapter. So Danny gets attacked by the woman in 237.
And 217.
217, pardon me. 237 in the movie. Sorry, I confused them. 217. So he gets attacked by the woman, and Wendy has said, like, you know, we got to get him out of here. And Jack's like reluctant, but he recognizes that, yes, it's the best thing to do is for Danny. And let's see if we can get a snowmobile operable. And he's in there and he gets the snowmobile operable, and he has this moment of reflection and insight. And I'll pull out this quote. He's looking at the snowmobile and he is a little resentful. Like, he's just like, I don't want to leave this place. This place is so good for me. And he thinks, in that instant, kneeling there, everything came clear to him. It was not just Danny. The Overlook was working on. It was working on him too. It wasn't Danny who was the weak link. It was him. He was the vulnerable one, the one who could be bent and twisted until something snapped. And he has this moment where, like, in this precipice moment, I think, for Jack Torrance's character, where he's like, I could get my son out of here with the snowmobile now, or I could succumb to the Overlook. And he recognizes that it is his weakness, mm-hmm. that the Overlook is exploiting to get to Danny. And yet he throws the carburetor, I think it is, the battery, I forget what it is. He throws the piece into the snow,
yeah.
dooming them to stay. And the chapter ends with him playing with Danny.
That moment where he goes out and he has a snowball fight with Danny after that, that's one of the moments that made me sick. Sick. And understanding, like, no matter, even if you're in control of the Overlook, like, that is your fucking family. That is your blood. That is the one thing that you are wholly responsible for. It's your son. And you sabotage any way of him getting off this mountain, and then you fucking play with him. It's disgusting. Now, I understand it's control of the Overlook that does that, but still, there's something that, like, you have to fight harder against the Overlook. If you recognize that you're the weak one, then you need, in my opinion, as the father, he needs to become strong.
Well,
and he doesn't.
And he does not. And in that moment, I think it's debatable how free he is.
I agree.
He recognizes that the Overlook kind of has him. And I think that's the moment where, if he were, that character were to have the strength, it would have been in that moment.
Yeah, sure.
But we also, when a pack of lions attacks a group of zebras, it's always the small and the weak ones that get caught.
Yeah.
And Jack is, though not physically the small, he is the small and the weak one here.
100%.
And the overlook, because Jack has a clear weakness. He has two, I think, two weaknesses that the overlook understands and dangles in front of his face until he snaps. Weakness one, he has rage. Weakness two, he's an alcoholic who has not recovered.
No.
He's on the road to when he goes there, you know, and but he has not fully recovered from his alcoholism. He's on the road to recovery. And those two things make him extra susceptible to the overlook dangling. We can let your anger out. You can do whatever you want here. Mm-hmm. There's no one for hundreds of miles. You can get away with whatever rage you want. And by the way, we'll give you a drink to wash it down.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because in the character Jack, what gets him to lose his job is not his drinking.
No, it's his rage.
It's his anger and him beating up a kid. And I love that. And this is the way that I think King complicates, pardon me, Jack so well. In the story, Jack is a teacher. He's got a student with a stutter. So he speeds up the timer on the debate. The student calls him out on it. And the student vandalizes his car. And in his rage that the student dare challenge the mighty Jack Torrance, he beats a minor with his fists. And this is well after he had been sobered up for a little while.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's no alcohol in him when he does that. That is purely the Jack rage. So the rage is what costs him his job. And ultimately, it's the rage and that I think is his main weakness that then leads into the drinking. And I think the overlook plays on his rage more so than any other aspect of his character. How dare they challenge you? How dare they conspire against you? How dare they do these things to make you not part of the overlook? Mm-hmm. It is your job. You could do great here. You in the overlook, your management material, and all of these things, this rage that he has in him, that it plays onto it, that then dangles that with, by the way, we'll give you booze too, that I think ultimately leads to him really succumbing. But I do think, at least my read of it this time around, is King is sympathetic to Jack. And I think the big piece of evidence to me is at the moment where Danny is cornered at the very end of the book and Jack could kill him. Danny says it's not his father's face he sees. And he tells that you're not my dad. And for a moment, his dad comes through and gives him enough time to escape. Mm-hmm. So at the most like deepest, darkest moment of Danny's journey, Danny is able to challenge the hotel and his father is at that point completely possessed.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I agree. Yeah. You know, the interesting part about that, that whole sequence for me, this is the first time we're reading something, you know, I know we keep going back to parental stuff and I apologize to anybody out there who finds that boring. But there's that one moment, you know, right before that acceptance happens where Danny tells the hotel, you know, you're not my daddy. And at one point in time, as soon as he sees Jack, he takes Jack's hand and Jack allows him to do that and looks at his father and says, I forget what the exact line is, but like, it's almost over. This is almost done. You know, we're going to be done with this soon. And that's where, that to me is where Danny, like his innocence is gone now. He has become, you know, the nucleus of this family, 100%.
Oh, man.
That's that moment.
That's a really good call out, dude.
That's that moment because later on, you know, we get to the end of the book and Danny's found some sort of peace. We know later on, if you've read or watched Dr. Sleep, we know that Danny is successful and makes it forward. And overcomes his last name, overcomes the overlook. But in that moment specifically, if you ask me, that's the moment where Danny becomes, unfortunately at 5 years old, goes from being a child to an adult.
Yeah, Danny looks into the face
of pure evil.
Of evil itself and is brave and says, "You're not my dad."
And has an empathetic response to his father in the hotel, which no one else, everybody else around him, including the hotel, including Stephen King himself, has a sympathetic response. But it's fucking Danny who has the empathetic response and says, "Daddy, I know. I get it. Oh, man. I've wept. I know what you're going through, and it's almost done."
It's a beautiful, beautiful moment in
it's
that
intense,
book.
It's intense, man.
You know, there's a narrative out there that Stephen King doesn't know how to do endings.
I don't know where that comes from anymore.
I don't believe it.
No.
I don't feel that way.
It's unfounded to me now.
I really don't, because that is a moment where the love of a son for a dad slows evil down enough so that the dad can say, "Get out, son."
Just for a millisecond.
And it's just enough, because if it wasn't for the love of a son for his father, Danny dies.
And that shit's beautiful.
It
among
really
all
is.
The terror, among all the grotesque and the weird and the nasty and the fucked up that is Stephen King, there are these moments of empathy and true connection as a human, because that's really what he's after as an author.
And that is a moment that redeems Jack.
Yeah.
Jack is redeemed. Wendy fully stabs Jack in the back, and that wound should have killed him.
Yeah.
And the Overlook takes control. At that point, you know, whatever was left of Jack is almost fully gone. Mm-hmm. There's enough there to slow down the Overlook to allow Danny to escape. But yeah, at that point, that is a point where,
you know, there have been specific moments in certain books throughout this entire journey that we've done that have really hit me hard, made me sob. You know, a couple of them being, you know, in the Losers Club and trying to fight Pennywise at every single turn. And, you know, the kids coming together and fighting for each other and exclaiming their love for one another. That whole sequence, the sequence when Eddie dies. Oh, man. Every single time it comes. The first time I was in college, I was on a SEPTA bus. I was on my way to an acting studio, and it fucked me up, man. But this moment with Danny reaching out, both with his mind, his soul, his body, and telling his father, it's almost done. It's that moment and like the last five or six pages of the book, I just ugly cried. For whatever reason, I just think the trauma that this family has been through, that they're able to find some peace, including Jack. Jack blowing up with the Overlook, it makes sense.
Yeah, and very different from the movie.
Oh, world. And I
because you get the sense in the book that the evil of the Overlook is those, the walls and brick and plaster.
We get the importance of that boiler for like the first 150 pages of this book. And then it fucking goes away. And nobody talks about it until what? Maybe the middle of the book when Jack goes back down and recalibrates it. And then for another 300 pages, there's no mention, not a single fucking mention of this boiler. And then at the very last second, boom, who remembers it? Danny remembers it. That's it. We're done. We've reached the final point of this hotel. The hotel used all of its energy to try to get to Danny, and it couldn't. And I think that's another interesting thing about people who have the touch and have the shine strongly. Look at Dick Halloran. This guy's been through war. He has been through the black spot. He's been through segregation, being a black man in America, to whatever was next for him. You know, they're resilient people. And that feeling of resilience, that feeling of how strong these characters are, it blew me away. And these specific moments of empathy where Stephen King can really empathize, he hits me in all the feels.
And while Dick Halloran has such little actual connection to the Torrances, other than that boy can shine and so can he.
Yeah.
And that is enough where he's just like, I will risk everything. And King throws every obstacle in Halloran's way.
Every one.
Every single thing to stop him. And Halloran still is able to get there. I want to back up a little bit to the boiler, if you don't mind. You know, because that was a really interesting thing you said. It kind of got my gears going that the boiler is talked about with such importance for such a big part of the book that it kind of disappears till the very end.
Yep.
I kind of read that the hotel kills itself.
I don't disagree. I think it finally met its match. It couldn't take over this family. It couldn't take over Danny. There was no point in its existence any longer.
And it ignores its own maintenance.
Yeah.
It possesses its caretaker. So it ignores, it's like if it were a body, it kills its own white blood cells.
Yep.
So that it can't be taken care of.
It causes its own cancer.
Because it lusts so much after this boy because of the boy's psychic powers. And in doing so, it sets up the very thing to destroy itself. Mm-hmm. And the hotel destroys itself.
Oh, yeah.
It blows itself up. Mm-hmm. Because the boiler is part of the hotel.
It's the heart of the hotel.
Yeah. And so it gives itself the equivalent of a hotel heart attack.
Yeah, literally.
I think that's an interesting point.
And, you know, I think we'd be remiss because there's one character we haven't talked too much about, and it's Wendy. And I think we should talk about Wendy.
Yeah, let's talk Wendy.
She's just such an integral part of this nucleus. You know, Wendy, for me, for a very long time, was the strongest character in the book. She kept this family alive. She kept the idea that, no, this is my blood. These are the people that I love. I will go through hell and back. I made these vows. You know, Jack's off the sauce. We're doing really well. Maybe, I don't know, bring in my five-year-old who has slight emotional problems into the middle of the mountains. You know, well, I trust my husband. And her trust in her family, unfortunately, blinds her at some point in time.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think if we look at Wendy and Jack and the theme of cycles of abuse, I think both of those characters, pre-going to the Overlook, are trying to be better than those cycles.
Yeah, I agree.
Excuse me, tickle in my throat. Jack is like, I hurt my son, I'm going to stop drinking. Whereas his father would keep drinking and keep hurting. Wendy is just like, I could be jealous of my husband and son's relationship and I could put a wedge between them the way that her mother has done, or I could try to accept it. I think they're both trying to break out of those cycles. Mm-hmm. I think Wendy is able to more successfully break out of that cycle, in particular when faced with the evil of the Overlook.
Yeah.
I think part of that is because of the power of motherhood and the power of empathy that being a mother has.
Yep.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. She's constantly empathizing with Jack and Danny and trying to put their needs first.
Especially Danny. Protecting Danny is the number one thing. We have to get Danny off of this mountain. We got to get Danny out of this hotel. This hotel is bad for Danny when in fact, it's bad for Jack, you know, but we have to get him off. How can you not see this? We have to get our son off of this fucking mountain. Who gives a shit when we get the Sidewinder? You and I talk about this all the time. When you're parents, you do. You just do. You figure it out. You're faced with impossible fucking needs. Your child's inconsolable. You can't feed them anything.
You haven't slept for 3 months.
You haven't. You just figure it out. And Wendy, at every step until she's literally beaten in the face with a rope mallet by her estranged husband, up until that moment, she constantly thinks, how am I going to protect this family from Jack, from the Overlook, from herself, from whatever this thing Danny has? You know, her constant, she's the caretaker. There's no question.
And when Jack is drunk in the hotel bar, and Wendy was recognized that he is a danger, and she's locked up. She realizes Danny's asleep. I've got to go look for him. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. I've got to go look for him, knowing that she's already seen the party favors in the elevator.
Yep.
Knowing that this place is coming to life. Knowing that her son has absolutely no doubt has psychic powers, she's like, my husband's lost his mind. There's nothing I can do. He'll be between me and the food my son needs.
Yeah.
I'm going to go try to talk to him. And he ends up, She ends up at that point underestimating how far he's gone.
And I'm going to lock his ass in a pantry.
But she still stabs him.
Yeah, right in the back. Right through the back. Watching him bleed out. All in protection of her son.
And I think it's worth noting that the power of motherhood and the power of the empathy being a mother, you know, Dick says every mom has a little bit of the shine.
Ugh.
Ugh. And I think that's true.
Because, it is true.
Oh, you know, sometimes I look at my son and I'm like, what's he thinking? And my wife is just like, oh, he's thinking this.
It's, I and mean, I'm like, that I've never
how did
seen
you know that?
And I've never seen dedication like that.
Yeah.
To another human being. And I think it's the one thing, granted, that sometimes I think fathers lose, especially in whatever kind of weird socioeconomic thing we've been put into, you know, that we're supposed to work and provide, blah, 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 blah. I mean, obviously, those things have changed in our lifetime, but reading a book from 1977, you know, it's all about Jack providing for this family, where in fact, Wendy is the one that's really providing for an adult that has an intense PTSD and a child that has intense PTSD.
Yeah, where Jack is constantly thinking about himself and the ramifications of what this is going to mean for him. Wendy is constantly thinking about Danny and Jack.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
very, very rarely is Wendy thinking about herself. You know, we've talked a lot about in previous episodes how King doesn't always seem to write women well. And I think, in my opinion, and ladies out there listening, please let me know if you agree or disagree. Mm-hmm. But I personally feel that Wendy is a phenomenal character. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's three main characters. Like, this is so unique for King.
That's another thing. It's true.
Because he loves a ton of characters, especially once you get past page 500 with a King book. There's probably four to five main characters.
Well, we get a fucking ballroom and a bunch of ballroom guests. And, like, his characters, Jack's characters as a writer coming to life, which I think is interesting. You know, he's there not really to take care of the hotel, but to write this play. And to finish this play, this is going to be the play that's going to make him, you know,
put him back on track.
Yeah, this great writer.
But what's so unique is that there are three main characters and then one like major side character in Dick, who in the second half of the book becomes more and more of a major character, but yeah, is definitely a prominent, but not major. Other than that, you have Ullman, the, you know, stuffy hotel director. You have the doctor they take Danny to. You have, you know, Jack's friend Al.
Yeah, who gets him the job.
But there's not a lot of characters. And so all of the three main with Dick as the second main. Mm-hmm. So those characters are so richly drawn. And I think Wendy is an exceptionally well-written character, in particular for Stephen King, who sometimes doesn't write the ladies as well. In my opinion, I think Wendy is the exception. And I would love to hear from female women identifying female fans president of Stephen King, yep, if they agree or disagree.
Yeah. I would love to know as well, because this is one of the first times I was like, man, when? All right, here we go. We've got a solid woman in here fighting for her family, stabbing her husband in the back. Wildly different from the Wendy in the movie, which I was very, honestly, it's very refreshing, if you ask me.
Yeah.
It was.
I like Wendy in the movie just fine. Wendy in the movie is one of the best horror movie performances, yeah, of all time.
Yeah.
So I don't have any antipathy towards Wendy in the movie. Wendy in the book has a lot. We get to see so much from her perspective.
Yeah.
So she feels like she has more agency than Wendy in the movie. But Wendy in the movie is acted so beautifully by Shelley Duvall, who's clearly abused. Whereas
absolutely,
Wendy in the book is dealing with a toxic situation, but she herself has not been abused by Jack. Like, she has always had a pretty good relationship. Mm-hmm. Jack directed his anger originally towards Danny. And that is the thing that, you know, that's the wedge between them. Obviously, the character Jack has huge toxic masculinity issues. He has the issue that, like, a woman should not tell him what to do ever. And the fact that he made a mistake, which was drink too much and hurt her son, is haunting him. And he does not like the power that gives Wendy. But Wendy doesn't see that as power.
Yeah.
Jack sees it as Wendy has power over me because she can lord this mistake over me. But Wendy just sees that it's just like, please don't hurt my kid.
You broke your two-year-old's arm. You know how hard that is? You know how much force, drunken force, he would have had to apply to break his arm like that?
So when my son wants to go to sleep, I usually hold him by the arms.
Yeah.
And he likes this. And I walk him up the stairs, swinging him from his arms. And him laughing. Like, if you did that to me as an adult, my arms would fall apart.
I'm sorry. Like, if I had broken my daughter's arm, I think my wife has every right for the next however long in our relationship to fear that I might do that again. I mean, trust is a hard thing to regain when it is broken. And you've got an already a family picking pieces up, trying to think that, this is going to be the thing that saves our family. And I think it's interesting, you know, another theme that King uses is this idea of fear being based around isolation and what isolation can truly do to the human spirit and to the human psyche. You know, I mean, it starts off with a hose. And it ends up with the Overlook blowing itself up and hedge animals attacking, two of the characters, you know?
I think that's a good point, man. I really do. Because the Overlook waits like a spider for them to be caught in the web of isolation.
In American Horror, there is a lot of study of isolation. You look at the Blair Witch Project. You know, you look at films where The Shining itself, Kubrick's Shining, where these films, they're so sparse. You know, in a way, you know, another Kubrick film in 2001, A Space Odyssey. The fact that there's very little, the first Alien. The fact that we're using isolation and silence because most people are uncomfortable in silence, you know, and playing with that fear. I mean, I was finishing the book 2 days ago. I finished it yesterday I finished it because we decided to do this yesterday evening tonight. I was outside taking my dog out to pee at 6 a.m. And man, I was freaked out because where we're at right now, there's a lot of wooded area. And I was standing out there and I was like, I got to get back in the house. I feel like I'm going to start hearing things. I feel like, you know, someone's going to hit me with the shine. I got to get the fuck inside. It was to the very end, you know, to the last five or six pages. It was horrifying.
You know, a little quote I want to pull out here. Danny calls Tony in the ballroom and he falls and he has a swollen lip. Wendy comes up and sees him and goes, "What happened, Doc?" she asked. Although she was sure she knew, Jack had hit him. Well, of course, that came next, didn't it? The wheels of progress, sooner or later, they took you back to where you started from.
Ah.
Cause a wheel.
Yeah.
Its only job is to turn.
Yeah.
And Wendy, having a little bit of the shine, as all moms do, knows that Jack wants to drink.
Yeah.
Knows that
more Jack, than anything.
Knows that Jack is mad, that he views his son and his wife as the impediments to his success, even though deep in his subconscious, whether he's at the Overlook or not, that thought exists in his mind. And instead of dealing with that thought, Jack takes his family to the isolation of the Colorado mountains rather than admit that he feels that way.
For an entire fucking winter.
And he could admit that he feels that way and go to therapy and get better.
Yeah.
Granted, it's the 70s. Therapy is a little more taboo when this is written.
But still, there's got to be a better.
He could admit that he feels that way.
Get a job at a supermarket or something, guy. Like, go out and get fucking two or three part-time jobs. Instead, you're going to take your. It's crazy to think that book starts with him interviewing for this position and thinking that, right. The key to my success, the key to me finishing this play is to take me and my family on the rocks to the middle of the fucking Rockies in the middle of the winter.
Yeah. Or he could get a job bagging groceries.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I'm flabbergasted.
And But it is him running away from the reality that he views his wife and son as the anchors from his success and the anchors from his desires, rather than him wanting to be successful to support them.
Right.
I'd rather go halfway across the country than actually admit how I feel.
Yeah.
And that is the toxic masculinity. That is the weakness
that
the overlook
exploits
as the hunter, as the psychic hunter sees and targets in Jack and exploits and uses that to turn Jack against his family enough to the point where it can eventually totally possess Jack.
Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely. I only have one real other thing that I brought in to talk about.
Let's do it.
Unless you had something else.
I don't.
I found that the epilogue had one of the best passages I had ever read. And it didn't occur to me the first time I read it. It definitely occurred to me the second time. And I think it sums up the themes of the book in a very beautiful Stephen King way. And it's at the very end, and I'm just going to read the quote. Dick and Danny are fishing, and the boy tried to answer, but the words were swallowed into a sob. He leaned his head against Halloran's shoulder and wept tears, now flooding down his face. Halloran held him and said nothing. The boy would have to shed his tear again and again, he knew, and it was Danny's luck that he was still young enough to be able to do that. The tears that heal are also the tears that scald and scourge. And I really thought about that quote. One, there's an acknowledgement from Dick that Danny's youth will allow him to cry, in that as you grow up to become a man, you're not allowed to. Mm-hmm. And that is another symbol of the toxic masculinity in Jack that will eventually come to Danny, that the overlook would exploit in Jack. And as we learn in Dr. Sleep, would it come to haunt Danny's character into adulthood. And then the tears that heal are also the tears that scald and scourge. Ugh. And to me, that is one of the best lines I've ever heard, is that there is no psychic or physical healing that doesn't involve a scar.
Yeah.
And that you cry to help to get over things, but you're never truly over. And to me, it is Dick looking at Dan and realizing that what's done, he'll get better. It may not come to define him in part, but he will never be free from the scar. And as a new parent, there's no deeper lesson that I think that, to your point, as a parent, you cannot do these things. You've got to do your best to protect your children from your insecurities, your doubts, your issues, becoming the tears that scald and scourge your son or daughter.
And you know, the truth is, in that respect, it's never going to be perfect. Some of that is going to seep through, right? That's just, for whatever reason, part of being human.
Cause a wheel.
You know, and but that line, I mean, it's also just makes me think about people you lose in your own life, you know, thinking about them in certain respects, specific memories, shedding those tears. It does feel good. It does lift that in that instant. The one thing it doesn't do is bring those people back, you know, or those original memories. And it's one of the hardest parts about living, you know, is that it's the living are the ones that have to suffer through it.
I totally agree with that, my friend. Well, this has been
Shining.
The Shining.
Oh, the one thing we didn't talk about. We'll end it on this. Out of the Stephen King books that we have read, where do you rate The Shining?
I don't compare. This is a new decision that I've made. I don't compare Stephen King books to The Dark Tower.
I've been saying that this whole time.
I'm no longer
doing, okay, great. So we're not tied. Okay. So it's outside of The Tower.
It's not fair because everything would be at best number 8.
Right.
Under The Dark Tower 7.
Right. So removing that.
Yeah. It's like when someone asks me what my favorite movie is, assume I'm not comparing it to Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Because it's just not fair to every other movie.
You can't.
You know? So I'm not going to compare this to The Seven of the Tower.
Yeah. So of the other books that we have read, where would you put this?
I think The Shining is one of the best books I have ever read. Mm. I am, you can hear me at a loss for words, people, which is really rare for
me. This is tough, I know.
In particular, in front of the microphone, I'd like to talk. I don't know if I can put it at number one. It's close. It's a very close. This book is one of the few Stephen King books outside of The Tower that I have had the occasion to read more than once.
Yeah.
And I do think this book, for where I'm at in my life, it really benefited for me to have a multiple readings. Aside from my life being turned upside down from the move, this was probably the easiest of his books for me to read.
Okay.
It's the book that I read the quickest. Mm-hmm. It's the book that I'm a slow reader. I'm not a fast reader at all. It's a book that I really could clip through at a very good rate for me. And I loved it. I will say it is very close between The Shining and it for me. It's very close.
That is the longest way to say that it's tied for number one.
I want to say it's number one.
Yeah, that's okay.
I just think
we have a lot more to read.
I think it is so phenomenal. If I'm pressed, if I have to pick.
I'm pressing you.
I
right
have
now.
To pick.
You have to pick.
If I don't pick, my family goes to the Overlook and they become
exactly.
ghosts.
Exactly.
Okay. If I have to pick, it would go It Shining.
Okay. Great.
But I'm not comfortable with that.
That's okay.
Because it was so hard for me to read.
Yeah.
It's a book I had to walk away and take a break from because it's so hard. It's so grotesque. It was very challenging. It was not comfortable. And I really did feel the sense of catharsis at the end of it, unlike any other book I've mm-hmm. read. The sense of catharsis at the end of it was really there. It I wept at. When the losers forgot everything as adults, I just absolutely lost control because I'm like, you did all of this and you don't even remember that you love each other. And I didn't have that same reaction to The Shining, but I will tell you, I've never been as glued to the book as I was to The Shining. Mm-hmm. I never felt more connected to character in the way I did with The Shining. So I don't know, dude. I'm talking myself right now into saying that it's The Shining. I don't know.
Wow.
What about you?
That's a really emotional decision for you. I have a very clear answer, and it's been this way. It's number two. Absolutely. Right behind it. It is still maybe the best thing I've ever read, period. But this is a clear number two for a lot of the same reasons. I couldn't put it down. I had a lot of the same emotional reactions where I had to put the book down and walk away, especially when it came to certain passages of abuse, you know, and dealing with certain things about, you know, your own insecurities as a father, as a person, as an artist, whatever, you know. So for me, it definitely was a clear number two. There's nothing above it other than it, hands down. It could be the scariest book I've ever read. I will say that.
That is another thing too. It is terrifying without a doubt, but The Shining is like the Shining raised my blood pressure.
Yeah, me too. And I agree with that.
When those hedge animals come to life and plop the snow, when Danny is stuck in that tunnel, that is had to have been the scariest thing I've ever read.
And a lot of it for me is, again, getting over that trauma, fear of clowns, right? That was a big, big, huge life win for me. So that might be part of the reason, but no matter what it is, The Shining is absolutely number two. It's incredibly well written. It's raw. It's real. I even love the fucking hedge animals, which I know some people have problems with. I think it's terrifying.
The hedge animals are some of the scariest part of the whole
book
to me.
That shit's terrifying.
So you obviously went online and saw what people thought, which I have not done about The Shining.
Yeah.
I did put a poll out there on Twitter, which is better, the book or the movie? And the book is absolutely crushing it on the poll.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
Which is no surprise because I talk to Stephen King fans on my Twitter,
right.
Not Stanley Kubrick fans.
Right.
I'm sure if I talked to the Kubrick fans, it'd be the other way. Yeah. But you seem to have seen online people don't like the hedge animals.
Yes, there's some hate for the hedge animals.
There's some hedge animal detractors.
I think more people want the maze. I kind of prefer the hedge animals.
I mean, different strokes for different folks.
Yeah.
I think they both work in their own medium.
Yeah.
I don't think
I agree.
The there was no CGI technology.
There's no way they were going to be able to do that.
So you can't really do the hedge animals and
now it would be like a Marvel scene where they've already spent all their money and it's just like the shittiest looking hedge animal in the world.
All right, let's not talk trash on the MCU.
No, but just their budget.
Yeah. So we agree it's one of King's best books
hands down out
of the tower.
Hands down.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's either one or two.
And it's fucking terrifying.
It is. It's the scariest book I've ever read.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
I mean, it is true American horror in a way that I've never heard. You know, there's other things that I was going to bring in, but we are way pressed on time because I definitely wanted to talk about Jack's obsession with the hotel as a postmodern American experiment and him wanting to write a history of it. But you know, maybe I'll put a Twitter thread out there about
that. There you go. Write an article.
All right. So what book are we going to do next, Steve?
Okay. Laurel has been asking us to do this for like 2 years. And I feel like, and also there has been some expressed interest on Twitter. So I believe we're going to do 11/22/63.
Boom. That's our next
book.
That's
the next one.
If you don't have a copy, pick it up. I think Steve and I are going to start reading this week.
I'll probably start it tomorrow if I don't go home and buy it tonight.
Depending when we publish this week could be many different things.
Yeah, it's true.
That's going to be our next book. I love this discussion. Until we meet again, long days and pleasant nights.
Long days and pleasant nights.